Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. A special welcome to all of our new listeners who found us through the Andrew Yang interview. Andrew is actually going to post that crossover episode on his podcast on Monday, so we expect even more of you to be incoming.
So for those of you who are new, here's what we're all about. We started over a year ago. Man, it's been a crazy bit of time, actually. We've done 50 episodes, and we do 2 episodes a week. We were really focused on DC policy at the start, really focused on these debates about the right, about what the future of the movie is going to look like. But as we've gotten further and further in it, as we've gotten better feedback, we've actually found that this realignment idea applies to way more than just whatever's happening inside the Beltway or in the New York to DC Acela corridor. So as Sagar talked about with Andrew, we're all about business, tech, culture. We really want to see this as a spot where we could have honest, like, interesting conversations that are going to be sort of unconventional with really interesting people.
That's right. And for those of you who are new, if you could really help us out, scroll to the bottom of that Apple Podcast app and hit 5 stars. It helps other people find the show. It's dramatically helpful to us here at The Realignment. And remember, reminder is a special treat that if you leave a 5-star review, you send a screenshot in to realignmentpod@gmail.com, we will answer any question that you have here on The Realignment. So Marshall, what do we have to start us off?
Joseph writes, "Hey guys, first off, I want to say I'm a huge fan of what you're doing. I think bringing attention to these issues and to the shit pot that our government is very important. My question's simple. What do you plan to do about it? Several progressive members of the media like Schenck and Kyle have founded groups like Justice Democrats, which is pushing left populists into Congress and are committed to serving their community, albeit in a way that I don't agree with. Do you guys have any plans, or have you heard of any plans to start a right populist PAC to push for the people Republicans into office?"
So it's a really, really interesting question, Joseph. And it's something that I've actually talked about on Rising quite a few times about how you need to have something like that. And I'm not going to claim and sit here that, you know, I have the expertise and the ability to run something like that. And part of what I try to focus my energy towards is actually something that the progressive leftists don't have to worry about, which is something that you've heard me talk about: staffing, personnel, people. You need a flagship. You need a place that people can congregate around, and you need a place in a pipeline for younger people who are interested in policy, who are interested in the ideas that we talk about here on this podcast, in order to come up. Because I'm just increasingly convinced at this point that a populist Republican can win the White House, even somebody like Donald Trump. And if you don't have the requisite number of personnel to actually fulfill the things that that president said that they would do in office, then nothing will get done. So that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, is trying to think about how to create such a pipeline. And since, frankly, it's a very nascent movement, I think we're about 10 years behind anybody in the progressive left, that you have to create a flagship first before you can even extend to something like a Justice Republicans. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And the thing that I want to sort of emphasize that you were talking about is, in terms of Sagar, my experience, we're media people. We came to DC. We have worked at places like the Daily Caller and PBS. We're doing this podcast, Sagar is Rising. Our expertise isn't actually in organizing PACs or organizing sort of grassroots efforts that are sort of probably intensive in terms of money. What we are actually good at, and what we're getting better at here, is actually building products like this podcast and like Rising that could speak to an actual population of people who are really interested in these issues. Because I think the thing that sort of is the thing that's most unserved in sort of the DC market space right now is just this broader, non-politically hacky, not really donor-driven conversation. So for example, something that really meant a lot to me is last week on Thursday, while Sagar was doing Andrew Yang, I had a conversation with Jacob Hellberg about the China issue. Jacob's a Democrat. He's a Pete Buttigieg person. He's a person who I suspect if Biden wins, he'll go in to work in the White House on some sort of national security issue. At the same time, he's just as much of a China hawk as we are. So the fact that we could have that conversation, and the fact that I actually got the strongest center-left feedback from our audience on that episode, was actually really helpful. And that in of itself is so important to do, because so much of what you sort of see when it comes to podcasts or media products in this space are things that are either sort of donor driven or inauthentic or just sort of doing lowest common denominator type conversations that don't really mean anything. They may get clicks, but they're just really superficial. I think people sort of recognize that. So that's what we're focused on doing.
And Marshall, you forgot one of the ways that we're going to be challenging Republicans in office and making sure that this populist movement is by selling mugs. No, that's just a joke. As we posed a question to all of you a couple of episodes back, we were like, do people even want mugs? Because one guy asked for one. And apparently enough of you do that we're going to figure it out. So stay tuned for some announcements here. And for the people who initially requested one, you will be getting one for free. So thank you. With that, it is with great pleasure that I can introduce our guest for today. That is Zed Jelani. He's host of The Back Channel on YouTube. He's a left-wing independent journalist who's written for many different publications from Think Progress. He used to work at the Center for American Progress. He worked at The Intercept. He's been somebody who I've been featuring on Rising now for over a year. I consider him to be one of the most insightful people in American politics. The reason I wanted to bring Zed on here for a conversation with Marshall and I is he is one of the few people I would consider, and he would consider really, on the progressive left, who have been kind of adamantly and staunchly opposed to some of the defund the police rhetoric and other rioting and looting rhetoric that we've been seeing that's been coming from that political sphere in the last couple of months. And the reason I find his position so fascinating, not just that he's a leftist, he's somebody who has been writing about police reform for literally over a decade. Zed is somebody who I know wants to challenge power, who wants to create a more egalitarian society. And so his take is one that I just feel is so valuable in a time of such charged political rhetoric.
So this episode means a lot to me on a couple of different levels, not only just as a Black person, obviously, but also the fact that I'm from Portland, Oregon. So when we're talking about looting and rioting and battles between Antifa and right-wing counter-protesters, this actually is something that I really deeply feel, and it's sort of something that's felt weird because for a long time, I sort of ascribed all of that to, oh, that's not really real, that's just sort of media stuff. But just over the past month, it feels like there's been a sea change. And what Zed, and we opened the episode with this, actually, it was he had a great tweet at the end of August where he just simply said, hey, as much as this election started with this discussion about reform and policy and how can we bring jobs back and raise wages, it's basically just descended into this culture war conversation. How can we have a normal country again? That's something that I just really deeply felt on a couple of different levels. So Zed, considering his legitimacy from the left perspective, because quick note, Sagar, nothing is more annoying than when people sort of bring up people who are either fake on the right, like a never Trumper, yeah, or fake right on the left. And we're like, hey guys, we've brought you this leftist who hates BLM. Like, no, that's not Zed's deal at all. He actually is on the left and thinks seriously about these issues. So I think he's the perfect person to talk about this in a good faith way. So we're going to dive in. And last thing before we do that, of course, our shout out to the Lincoln Network. Lincoln Network is doing an awesome job of sponsoring this podcast. We've done 10 episodes with them since we left Hudson. They've been nothing but supportive, nothing but encouraging us, not only doing more episodes, but also being really frank with you guys. So I appreciate their work. Sagar does as well, too. On to the interview.
Zed Jelani, welcome to The Realignment.
Yes, great to be here.
Absolutely. So Zed, he's host of The Back Channel. It's a great new YouTube channel where they're having some interesting conversations. Many of you might actually recognize him from his weekly appearance on Rising. Anytime there's anything going on in the news, basically concerning anything, I go to Zed's Twitter feed and I say, what should I think about this? Because he is clearly one of the most intelligent and best articulators in American politics today. And we have a lot that we want to get with you today, Zed. Marshall, what do we have to start?
So Zed, you had a tweet in August that I bookmarked because I thought it was really profound and it sort of spoke to a lot of what I want to focus on this show, but also with the realignment moving forward. And what you tweeted was, and Phil can add this to the video version, increasingly, it feels as if the goal of the 2020 election is not any kind of populist or any kind of reformist agenda, but just having a normal country with normal political discourse without civil war levels of polarization and contempt seeping into everything. So what were you thinking? I can't imagine what in the news would be driving that tweet a few weeks ago. But yeah, let's dive into that.
Yeah, so I think when the 2020 election kind of kicked off, probably more than a year ago, you had Democrats contesting for the presidency, going through the primary process. You had third parties doing their thing. I think everyone kind of had a policy agenda, right? Like, are we going to have Medicare for all? Are we going to have a Green New Deal? What's Trump's second term agenda look like? Now we're primarily talking about surviving a pandemic, escaping double digit unemployment, and preventing, I guess, a series of, one, police abuses, and two, riots and looting and arson, and now even street battles between people of different political affiliations. We're talking about trying to roll back the clock to maybe 2012, 2013, 2014, a time in our country when at least it didn't feel like everything was going down the drain. And that's just so different from what, we thought we'd be talking about a year ago. We thought we maybe we'd be talking about an ambitious agenda of changing so many things about America away from the status quo. But now we're looking back at the status quo kind of fondly because we've gone in such a sort of we've gone in an apocalyptic direction in so many different ways. And we've seen the breakdown of so much that we often just took for granted. We took for granted that we had a public health system in this country. We took for granted that we had, for the past 3 or 4 years, near full employment, not total full employment, but near full employment. We took those things for granted. So we were talking about going to the next step. We were talking about how can we have some kind of universal health care everyone's taken care of? How can we have higher wages for everybody? How can we rebuild manufacturing? These were questions that were at the top of our minds, but now we've lost what little we had. So we're, in some ways, we're growing much more conservative. We're kind of saying, we'll settle just for kind of having a normal country with institutions that can function without people fighting in the streets. And unfortunately, it looks like this is going to have to take away a lot of our ambition in terms of what we wanted to see from the government over the next couple of years, because we might just be clawing our way back up to where we were just a few years ago.
Sagar, follow up on me, but what I think is so funny here is that the Biden campaign needs to hire you as a campaign surrogate, because I think you just summed up in one paragraph basically why you would want a Biden presidency over Bernie, over Trump. You sort of just explained why I think the primary on the Democrat side went. But yeah, Sagar, there's a follow up.
I mean, sure. Zed, I completely agree with you. And that's actually maddening to me because we've talked now for over a year on my show, which is that I really thought when this pandemic began that this was the populist moment, and having it coincided with the death of Bernie Sanders in his campaign, with the acquiescence to Joe Biden, I was like, this is it. This is Trump's moment. Now, none of that ended up happening economically, even on so much of what we see right now. And the reason I really wanted to have you on to discuss this and the normality of it in particular is how insane our current political rhetoric is around what's happening in the streets of America. And when you talk about that normality, when you talk about going back to the niceties of 2012, what we're really talking about there is literally not having people out in the street burning things to the ground. But we also, of course, need to recognize that it is a legitimate response to something. Just how have you seen that embrace of normality kind of take force with the public? And how do you connect it to everything that's going on and the irresponsibility of political leaders on both sides?
Well, look, I think that, one of the ideas that animates, I think, American political discussion has always been, like, it's called American exceptionalism, right? American exceptionalism is this idea that we are, the shining city on the hill, that we are a place that has almost unique respect and adherence to certain liberal democratic values, like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, checks and balances in government. And I think that's been shaken up over the past few years. Like, a lot of people feel like those aren't guarantees in the United States anymore. And I think that first form of American exceptionalism is almost being challenged by a second form of American exceptionalism now. The first one kind of said that America is, like, uniquely, like, valorous. It's a very, it's a uniquely special place to live, a place that is a destination for people around the world. I think the second form of American exceptionalism is almost arguing that America is uniquely flawed, right, that it has kind of unique evils, and that it's in need of some kind of reckoning or rebirth. And I think those two forms of American exceptionalism have almost kind of clashed with each other at the same time, as we had, I think, a president who had built his message based on, I think, a lot of nostalgia. The slogan "Make America Great Again" was very compelling for a lot of people, particularly older people, who felt like many things socially, culturally, economically in America have been very, very unsettled by globalization, by changing demographics, by increasing, I think, coastal control of cultural and social narratives. And I think that that kind of vision is now under almost a polar opposite assault, which is a group of people who I think today it was announced that there's some sort of committee in Washington, D.C. that has decided that they should be removing monuments to Thomas Jefferson, to George Washington. I think Francis Scott Key might have been on there. A range of people who are founding fathers from our nation's capital, because I think many of these people view our nation at some kind of fundamental level as flawed or irredeemable and needing some kind of reckoning or rebirth. So on one hand, we have people who kind of want to go to back to the past, and on the other hand, we have people who kind of want to destroy the past and start over, right? And I think these two currents at the same time are squeezing so many people who are in the middle of these visions. I think the contemporary kind of normie idea the average person has that America has its flaws, but it's actually a pretty good country to live in. There's so much about our kind of norms that we've developed that we value and treasure. But now we're kind of being squeezed from both sides in terms of having those basic norms and values under questioned, undermined, a suggestion that, we actually can't be the America we were in 2013 or 2014, or any of the years prior. And I think a lot of that has culminated in this violence. I mean, we've seen how this violence is being depicted and almost kind of shielded by differing political sides. It was once a norm in American political life that political violence is not acceptable. You can't just go up to somebody and assault them, or you can't burn down a building, can't, or break through a window. And I think for the past few months, we've seen that norm shattered in a range of places, from Chicago and Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, other parts of America. And I think much of the political left in its prominence in the news media, in its prominence in politics, has not necessarily embraced this violence, but I think they've downplayed it, minimized it, and generally have rendered it invisible because to them, it's not as consequential as if someone on the right was doing it, right? It's not the act itself that's so horrifying to them, it's who's doing it who's horrifying. And I think when we actually had conservatives take part in some of this violence over the past week, first we had the guy and the young man in Kenosha who was in some kind of altercation that escalated into gunfire and he ended up killing two people. And we also had a sort of a caravan of hardcore Trump supporters go through Portland, which also kind of escalated into some kind of violence and ended up killing a conservative person. I think at that point, this violence became much more real to liberals because they perceived it as coming from the right. When it was coming from the left, perhaps at some level they acknowledged it, but it didn't bother them very much. And that's very, very unusual. It should be extremely troubling to Americans, whether someone from the extreme left or the extreme right is engaged in any kind of violence, because that's seen as violating our basic, like, core liberal democratic norms that have governed the United States for so long. If even the issue of violence can now be polarized, and that, by the way, this is also on the right, like, Trump was asked about people shooting paintball guns at basically, I guess I don't know if they're Antifa people or just liberal counter protesters in Portland. And Trump basically excuses that, oh, it's not a big deal, it's not bullets. Like, that's very, very unusual,
Yeah, it's
actually,
shameful. Right. It's
to
shameful.
see a politician excusing violence from anybody, right? But now I think both on the left, represented through their politicians and also through a lot of mainstream media, which is left leaning now, like CNN will stand in front of a burning building and say it's mostly peaceful. They'll dispatch a reporter to Portland who goes to a peaceful part of it and say, oh, there's no violence happening here, even though there's been 90 days of like fires, arson, assaults on police officers, looting. And it's really making a lot of people, I think, like me, who for so long had been opponents of the status quo, had done investigative reporting about, corruption in politics and deprivations in the economy, who wanted to see a more kind of populist agenda. I think a lot of us now would settle for just having a more normal America, right? For having a place that at least doesn't descend into chaotic civil violence, that can control the pandemic, it doesn't have double-digit unemployment at least. But right now, I think that right now the room for actual legitimate populism is almost being undermined by all the street fighting and the violence, because we don't want to be Weimar Germany, right? Like, Weimar Germany was a circumstance where extremists on left and right engaged in street battles. The ones on the right won, and they established a dictatorship, right? There wasn't room for the social democratic reforms that maybe you saw in post-war World War II Germany, because all the energy and the activism of trying to change the country went from populism to extremism. And if that's the case, if that's where the populist winds are now going towards extremism, you almost have no choice but then to start rooting for kind of the older status quo that you detested or despised for so long, because that's actually preferable to going into the extremism route.
Can you? So I'm from Portland, so I really viscerally, I Portland Portland suburbs. Any Oregonian listeners will attack me for claiming I'm from the literal city of Portland. But that being said, I sort of feel this viscerally. What would be useful, since you're on the left, is can you help interrogate the different impulses that Democrats and people on the left are sort of navigating? Because on the one hand, I know Twitter is not real life, but there's this book that's going around that's in defense of rioting, which is this very intellectual case for why rioting is okay, why it's justified, how people who attack rioting are engaged in various acts of racism in themselves. So that's one impulse, but there's also the impulse of, hey, you know, we don't want backlash politics like in 1968 to have Trump win re-election. So how are Democrats and how are Democrats navigating all these competing impulses?
Yeah, so there is definitely a faction of people who are actively in favor of looting and rioting. They view it as a rational or maybe even unavoidable response to various systemic injustices. I think that faction is actually fairly small. So like Gallup does polling on this. Gallup recently discovered that I think 8% of Americans think that, you know, arson, looting, rioting are justified. You know, so you were talking about 92% of Americans don't actually support this in any way. But I think almost the bigger problem is that there's kind of a soft minimizing of it. Because I think a lot of Democrats, and you'll talk to people like people I know, or people who happen to be involved in liberal writing or politics, I think they think that acknowledging this violence as a problem is helping Donald Trump, right? It's entirely politicized now. You can only acknowledge or accept a reality if that reality comports to your political agenda, which is why I think a lot of these mainstream news outlets are minimizing the violence, is because they have this sense that like it'll help Donald Trump. You know, of course, it's not supposed to be the news media's job to help one side or the other, but I think we've kind of crossed that. That's another one of the norms in American journalism that I think have been severely undermined over the past few years. And so I think that, for instance, like Joe Biden, I don't think Joe Biden is in favor of any kind of rioting or looting. He's always been a somewhat more conservative Democrat on law and order. I don't think he has any love for it at all. But I do think he probably imagines that the more that he acknowledges or highlights it, the more it helps Donald Trump, because the research generally shows that disorder and chaos makes people more conservative. In fact, when they do psychology experiments, even if you put someone in a room with like stinking trash, they get more socially conservative when they like answer survey questions, right? Like people want some kind of order in their lives. And I think Biden knows that. And I think he was kind of forced to address it in an actual speech this week because it became so prominent all over the news media. Finally started to break through a little bit, although it's been kind of at a low level in areas like Portland and Seattle for quite some time. And I think that's also part of the reason why Biden, even when he did condemn the rioting and looting, which I think was fairly straightforward, it was a decent statement, he made pains to name specific right-wing actors like militias, white supremacists, so on and so forth. He didn't do any on the left. Like, he didn't specifically name like Antifa or any organization on the far left. And I think part of that is he doesn't want to accept any responsibility for the left in this. And I don't think he wants to accept responsibility, for instance, for Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, who has gone very soft on protesters, on rioters, to the extent that like when the state government requested surrounding counties to send backup police to Portland, they just didn't want to come, because the DA in Portland keeps letting people off when they get arrested for rioting related charges, if they're some of the more minor charges, as opposed to like they won't let someone off for like assaulting a police officer, but they might let someone off for disorderly conduct or something. Of course, those minor crimes typically escalate to more major crimes. Like if you look at like the arrest record of anyone who's like committed homicide, they'll have a bunch of minor crimes. And the main suspect in the shooting in Portland this past week has a bunch of minor crimes that kind of led up to this, and he was let go for them, including possessing a loaded firearm in a city in public. So I think, you know, it's not so much that most of the left or Democrats are in favor of this. I don't think they're in favor of this. But I think they think that acknowledging it, or acknowledging that particularly officials in their political party are failing to deal with it, is a gift to Donald Trump. That's why we get these really kind of distorted or hemming and hawing kind of statements about it. They aren't just acknowledging that the vast majority of the violence over the past few months has come from people that are on the extreme left. It doesn't mean they're representative of the left. It just happens to be a fact that they're on the extreme left. And that it's primarily the job of Democratic officials, mayors, and governors to tackle them. And I think some of them have done it well. I think, for instance, in the American South, you've seen very little rioting. There was a little bit in Birmingham, a little bit in Atlanta, But the mayors there pretty quickly shut it down. The only major mistake they made was that there was a scene of a police shooting outside of Wendy's in Atlanta that they kind of let armed individuals kind of camp out in. One of those individuals ended up shooting at a car and killing a poor African-American child, a little girl. That was probably the one big mistake I would say they made was letting those people camp out there. They cleared it after that. But for the most part, I'd say most of the country has handled this fairly effectively. I think we're talking about some liberal big cities that, you know, I think the reason they're seeing such extensive rioting is just because of their own ideology, right? It has nothing to do with the social condition of their cities, right? Like there are very few black people in the cities of Seattle and Portland. You look at these protests, they're primarily white folks. Sometimes the Portland Police Department appears to be more diverse than the actual people protesting against the Portland Police Department. I think that has a lot to do with the ideology of the people in those cities. And I think that ideology is in some ways hurting Joe Biden, because the average voter can see that these people are in the same political coalition. They understand it's not Biden sanctioning this, not Biden doing this, but there are people in his political party who occasionally are rationalizing this or downplaying it or minimizing it or facing to address it. And I do think that is part of the political anchor that kind of weighed on Biden enough to where he did come out and make some statements this week. Probably not enough to where he should actually be identifying that, you know, there are people on the left doing this. Mm-hmm. And I oppose them. And I think that officials, Democrat or Republican, need to be, you know, prosecuting these people even when they're, you know, right now they're not. But yeah, it is a sad moment, and it's another kind of expression of the lack of normalization in American politics, because typically speaking, you know, I think if this was happening in 2012, Obama and Romney would probably come together, make a joint statement saying, if you're on the left or you're on the right, stop the violence, stop arson, looting, shooting, you know, this is all unacceptable. Now, Biden and Trump really can't do that. All they can really do is argue the other one's responsible, which, by the way, neither of them are directly responsible, because the president does not run the security situation of a city or a state. Primarily the cities and states do. But in our polarized environment, that's what's happening.
Yeah, and Zed, you said something which seems very key to me, which is you were talking about basically the normalization or the forgiveness, the uncomfort with addressing political violence coming from somebody who's within the Democratic coalition. What does that do, and how does that undermine the legitimacy of order itself? Because I think that that's something you have been talking about a lot, and you've taken a lot of flack for it, you know, defending the idea that we do actually need order in, you know, in societies, and that in security vacuums, you will see the emergence of literal open street battles. I actually tweeted, it's something, an idea I stole from you. You had actually had, I think you tweeted this months ago, where you talked about the security vacuum in Iraq after like the disbanding of the Iraqi security forces, de-bathification, and how quickly that things can just spiral completely out of control. Just talk about that, you know, like a left defense of the legitimacy of the idea of order itself. And let's make clear, like, we're not talking about order in the way Trump means it, or in the way that, you know, right-wingers on Twitter are meaning it. I'm saying, like, literally the legitimacy of an authority who's tasked with combating crime and with making sure that property is not destroyed in American cities and in American life.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the phrase law and order is probably very politicized now. Other than like the hit TV show that people associate that with.
Right.
They probably associate it with Richard Nixon, Donald Trump, so on and so forth. But what we're talking about here really is like, you know, do you have the freedom or liberty to like, you know, to traverse public terrain, to be at home and not worry about being harassed, assaulted, beaten, hurt in some way? That, you know, this is one of the most important like things that the government can do, right? And it's usually so basic that we don't talk about it. Like, it's just such a broad agreement among left and right and people in government that this is the very first thing the government needs to do is secure your safety, that we don't talk about it. But I think there's just been so much chaos and disorder over the past few months to where it is calling into question for a lot of people who I think didn't have this question before, whether or not the government can actually assure that for them. Typically, it's, you know, there are places in America where there's been longstanding chaos and disorder. You know, there's a book, Ghetto Side, by Jill Leoby, where she writes about this. You know, there are like, you know, West Baltimore or parts of St. Louis or parts of Chicago, South Side of Chicago, There are certainly like been troubled neighborhoods for a very long time. I think that trouble is spreading, though, is the problem. So, for instance, like there's a really great Wall Street Journal reported piece in there. I think there's a Washington Post one as well, about how people in Minneapolis are forming militias, similar to what we saw in Kenosha with people standing with long rifles, guarding their businesses. That's actually becoming like a common thing in Minneapolis now. I've been to Minneapolis. I know quite a bit about Minneapolis. It's a liberal kind of city, a very hipsterish. Like, you wouldn't imagine that's the kind of place where people would actually take up and open carry rifles to protect themselves. And part of that is that there's just been such a surge of violence in Minneapolis. There's been an increase in shootings, homicides, other types of crimes, and police are stretched so thin. A lot of police have resigned, and I imagine there's also kind of a police pullback. Roland Fryer had a really great paper. He's a Harvard academic, where he looked at any city where there is a viral kind of incident of police abuse or alleged police abuse, and then there's an investigation. You typically start to see a police pullback when you have those two things combined. He estimated that there were something like 1,000 additional deaths in like five American cities as a result of that. I imagine that's what's happening in Minneapolis right now, although it's probably too soon for someone to have studied it, looked at it very closely. And what happens when there's not like accessible police is the same thing that happens in any part of the world or parts of America that are very troubled or poor, is that people kind of have to take things into their own hands. I think that's exactly what we saw in Seattle, for instance, in the so-called Chaz Chop, the free zone, was there was no police allowed in these city blocks. So if you're a criminal, you're thinking if you want to do something, go down to the Chaz Chop and do it. And it wasn't until four different shootings happened and two people died, including a teenager, that finally the city said, hey, we're not going to allow this anymore, and tore it down, and allowed police to freely move in that area. And I think that's a miniature version of that happened in Kenosha with this kid. I mean, there were, I remember Julio Rosas, who's a reporter. He was on the scene. He was taking video. There were a number of Daily Caller people on the scene taking video. I remember watching that and thinking, this is gonna, something bad's gonna happen here, because there were people who were rioting, who wanted to burn things down, arguing with people who wanted to protect those things. Both sides had guns. At some point, somebody was going to hurt somebody, right? And the police weren't there. And part of that is, on my podcast, the Back Channel, I just interviewed a journalist, Steve Horn, who's raised in Kenosha, knows it very well. He was explaining that this is largely a matter of like police being stretched very thin. Like the parts of the city that weren't burned down had very heavy police presence. Uptown, where there was very severe damage, police were just so stretched so thin that they really couldn't get to this area to protect it. And I don't know what happened when it came to the shooting. There were no police to be seen anywhere in these videos. I mean, here's the reality. Like somebody has to negotiate these disputes, right? Somebody has to be on the scene, to protect people and to prevent them from fighting each other. As soon as you take those people off the scene, and there's people with guns arguing with each other, someone's gonna get shot, someone's gonna get hurt. This isn't, it's not a fair expectation to ask everyone to be Chuck Norris or Jackie Chan and moderate all their own violent disputes without the state playing any role. In fact, it's actually quite cruel. I think that the fact that, I don't know, 40, only 40% or something of homicides get solved in some parts of Chicago or Baltimore, I think that's very cruel. You're not delivering any solace to the people who lose their family members to gun violence when you don't have properly resourced police who can solve these crimes and get people behind bars who need to be behind bars because they've done something very horrible. That is spreading now. There are more places in America that are seeing that kind of chaos and disorder. We've seen surges of homicides in places like New York City. We've even seen them in Portland. In July, Portland had its highest number of homicides of any time in 3 decades. Portland is not typically seen as a very violent city, but it's pretty obvious that what's happening is that police are all dragged to the city center, to this federal courthouse, to protect it every night from Antifa people who are rioting. And they don't have the resources to be everywhere in the city proactively policing in a way they would that could deter violence, right? And there's even some nights where they can't make it to every emergency call or to everyone who calls 911 because they're just so tied up in this situation. And I think that's a real problem. And the reason it's a problem is because, we have to look at the big picture. Yes, everybody wants like police reforms. Everybody wants it to be that people are not shot unless it's absolutely necessary, unless there's like an imminent threat of like lethal danger. But you can't, if we're creating a more insecure situation in the response to that, and even more people are losing their lives, I don't see how that's any better, right? At the end of the day, we're trying to save lives. We're not just trying to eliminate police abuse. We're trying to have a balance here in terms of policing presence versus saving lives. And if we just wanted to eliminate abuses by police, we could just eliminate police. That's right. I mean, there was an op-ed in the New York Times advocating for that. I think in Austin they passed, I don't know if it was a 50% reduction in police budget, or it was a huge reduction in police budget. And now police are having to pull units off of really important tasks that I'm sure are going to lead to some loss of life in the future. I think there has to be a recognition here that we have to be able to tackle things like policing and crime together. We can't just tackle one side of it. The goal is not just to cut down the police as much as you can, or to pull them back as much as you can just for the sake of doing that, because we have to look at what the impact of doing that is. And we have to be able to weigh different things. And I think that gets back to we want a more normal country, because I think a normal country would be weighing those things. But I think increasingly we're in silos where we have political tribes that are only, they're so ideological that they're only pursuing one objective. And I think in some of these cases, they're only pursuing the objective of reducing policing, reducing police forces, defunding the police, maybe even eliminating, some people want to eliminate police. I mean, that's fine. You can do that, but it's fine in the same sense that, if you have a cut on your hand and you chop off your hand, you no longer have the cut on your hand. It's true. But now you have a new problem, right? And I
So
think you have to look at the consequences.
I want to hit something, because I think if we stopped the podcast here, a lot of our listeners who haven't encountered you before would think you're probably a right winger. Not in a bad way, but you're saying a lot of things that line up well with the right. But the part about you that's really interesting and why you have the credibility to talk about this issue as a person in the middle is that you're a reformer. As you were saying at the start of the episode, before this year, you were sort of on the other side of a lot of these sort of debates. So, firstly, what do you say to someone who would object to your description of policing in America, aka the broader criminal justice system, as just a cut on the hand, right? Because if I'm putting on a BLM activist hat, if I'm putting on any sort of left of center hat, I'd say, no, policing is not a cut on a hand. Policing is a festering, maybe even fatal wound that is at the core of American society. So A, what do you say to that person? And then B, what did 2019 unnormal populist Zed want from the police? Because I guess I'm betting that wasn't sort of defunding, but how do you think about those two dynamics?
Yeah, I mean, it is important to situate myself a little bit here. I've been writing about policing issues, I don't know, for probably a decade or maybe less than that. It was a beat that I would occasionally jump onto, primarily from the reform side. So, for instance, I was born in a town called Mableton outside Atlanta, a very fairly small town. It was kind of the poorer, kind of more minority part of Cobb County. Later I moved from there, but the commissioner from Cobb County was a black woman from that part of Cobb County. It happened to be that she was studying for her, I think it was her bar exam. Late at night, she was driving. She was racially profiled by a cop who chased her down in the dead of the night. She called 911 on him, which is really funny, calling 911 on the police. And I wanted to find out what was the response from the city council, because I heard it wasn't great. So I did a FOIA, Freedom of Information, or whatever the local equivalent request was. I got all their emails and published a story. I helped expose the reality that my county was basically abusing this woman, not taking any sympathy for her after she'd been clearly racially profiled when she was completely innocent. In 2014, I reported for Vanity Fair about police militarization and efforts in Congress to roll that back. I've written many stories that I think are skeptical of the way that policing is done in the United States. And particularly the way the incarceration is done in the United States, which I think our incarceration is worse than our policing, and I'll get to that in a bit. The reality is, though, that there is a reason all this exists, and I think a lot of this debate has shifted from let's reform these institutions because we need them, but they could be operating better, to let's eliminate these institutions. There's something crooked or unnerving. There's something deeply rotted and
Right.
rooted in their behavior that just can be eliminated. There's no way to reform this, right? It's like trying to
Let me
reform. You
jump in
can't.
there, Zed. let me jump in there with a similar question, because yeah, we have to be fair to some of our progressive leftist listeners. They would say, okay, Zed, we don't actually mean defund the police. We are taking the maximalist position in order to get reform, because people like you have been talking about reform for the last decade and Black people are still getting shot in America. What's your response?
Yeah, I'm someone who's sympathetic typically when people say that we need to push the margins of a debate in order to move it in the right direction. The problem is it might not be the right direction, right? Like talking about limiting police to get us to a place where we're defunding and cutting their budgets might not be the right direction. I don't think you necessarily improve police by cutting their budgets, because I don't think you necessarily improve any institution by cutting its budgets. Sometimes, maybe, but I don't think of it as kind of a blanket answer to basically anything. Police need training. They need people on the scene. One of the worst, I think, police departments with one of the worst records in America when it comes to like shootings, abuses, like Las Cruces in New Mexico. It's a very, very poor town. I think when a police officer arrives at a scene, they probably don't have very much training. They typically don't have a lot of backup. They just, it's them and their gun, right? That's very different than I'd say a place like New York City. New York City, I think police officers were at one point shooting hundreds of people a year, like in the 1970s or something like that, right? Like I think in the last couple of years, they've only used their guns maybe 24 times a year or something like that. 99.99% of NYPD interactions with people do not end in any kind of gunfire. They've steadily improved, I think partially because they've steadily modernized, and that took a larger budget, right? I think if you're defunding a public service, it's very, very hard to say that you're improving it. So in this case, I actually don't support the maximal kind of positioning because I think it pushes the debate in the wrong direction. We shouldn't be talking about defunding a service that needs to be improved in many ways. And part of the way that it's improved is with more training, with more support and resources. Chicago just announced, I think this week, they're going to try to get free mental health care to all of their police officers. I read that and I thought, this is one of the most violent cities in America. The average police officer sees dead bodies like every month, right? They're not getting mental health service, like not until now. Mm-hmm. Did they have mm-hmm. that? They should have had this years ago.
Well, quick thing. What about the moderate maximalist position, right? Because obviously there are the people who are saying we want to defund police. But let's be real. We're talking about progressives and liberal cities. It's not like anyone's talking about lowering the budget and then refunding the money back to taxpayers. The moderate maximalist argument is that we should take the $10 billion budget, cut some of it, not get rid of that money, but reallocate that money. So for example, what they typically say, I want to know what your response to this is. Why are we expecting, who was it? Oh, Derek Thompson at the Atlantic had a good op-ed where he was like, we need to unbundle the police. A policeman in America does six different things. They're a mental health counselor. They're oftentimes a family court officer. They're doing all these sort of different things. And what we can do in a quote unquote moderate version of defund the police is we could defund the police budget, keep the training part, keep the gun safety part, keep the mental health services, but also say, hey, like we don't need to have cops responding to mental health crises where there isn't a clear sense of danger. How do you respond to that moderate version of the argument?
I think what was just described is probably what most police officers in America would tell you they want, right? They don't want
really.
They don't want to be responding to situations that are clearly not like the easiest thing in the world to do if you're a cop is to just like sit in your car or like not go out and patrol or just like be extremely lazy because you're not going to end up in a situation that's going to end up on YouTube and you're not going to get investigated and potentially fired or arrested for doing your job. Which in the past few years, there have been several police officers who went through very thorough investigations when they didn't actually do anything wrong. I think a lot of police officers would prefer to have a social service person respond to a situation either instead of a police officer or with the police officer, right? So they can help de-escalate the situation, which is often what Baltimore does. And I think there's a program in Oregon called CAHOOTS, which actually has mental health service workers and nonprofit people working with the police to do that. So I think the average police officer in America would be very much in favor of that. My problem with that is when you're starting with the defunding question, because it kind of, it takes an austerity mindset, right? It kind of pretends that like police in America are sitting on like a giant pot of gold, like Scrooge McDuck, you know, they're jumping into it. And if you just redistribute a little bit of that across the departments, you know, you'll see magical results. That's just not the case. Actually, America is actually, if you compare us to like the other OECD countries in Europe, we actually don't spend that much money on policing. The thing that we spend a ton of money on is incarceration. we're way off the charts on incarceration in terms of how much money we spend on that, but we're actually very much within the average or a little bit below average on policing. And I don't think that the police have that much money that you can just take some and throw it at another department and it's gonna create these results. I'll give you one example. In New York City, the homelessness budget, the entire budget for homelessness is like one half of what the NYPD's budget is, right? That shows you that like they're spending, you know, the NYPD does not have that much money, right? It's not like if you start cutting them and giving it to different places, you generate all this money. Probably would be better to figure out revenue sources, right? Probably be able to better to figure out ways to capture more money to fund those other departments. And I would start defunding police if and when you see the results of that other funding working. Because the reality is throwing money at problems doesn't always work. Sometimes there are plenty of programs for homelessness that have been complete disasters. There have been some programs for homelessness that work very well. It's not simply a matter of moving money around, and particularly with this misunderstanding, I think defund the police is created that police have all this money. They really, really don't. Like, it's really...
So this is so fascinating. I just realized it's like these people believe in a maximalist mindset on economics and yet embrace austerity whenever it comes to public services, which is kind of interesting. It seems so incongruent with their general framework that if you were to talk about, let's say, Medicare for all or a Green New Deal, then all of a sudden, you know, then you're somebody who's adopting a scarcity mindset. Why is it that somehow it's almost like a right-wing talking point that this has evolved into?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would expect the Cato Institute or Reason Magazine or somebody like them to be the number one proponents of defunding the police. I think defund the police is kind of, okay, so Jonathan Haidt, psychologist, he talks about the rider and the elephant. That's how we decide our political beliefs. The rider is the emotional half, the rider is the rational half. I think defund the police is very like towards our elephant, right? It's telling people are angry at the police. They see these videos. They think we want to punish the police in some way, so we need to defund them. We need to take money away from them and give it to something else. Even if the police don't really have that much money to begin with, and even if taking that money away from them could make policing less professional, could make people, good cops, leave the force. We've seen droves of retirements in Minneapolis, droves of retirements in many major cities across America. It's the same with teaching, right? If you start cutting teaching salaries, it's much harder to recruit people into the teaching profession who have master's degrees, who have at least a few years of experience and are professionals, right? You're deprofessionalizing whatever you're cutting. And I think that the defunding the police, there may be some post hoc rationalizations that people are making saying, well, it'll have X, Y, and Z great impact. But the reality is, I think it's mostly seen as a proxy for some way punishing this institution they see as irredeemably corrupt. And, you know, by the way, I think it's worth at least talking about, you know, what policing and a broader picture looks like, because I think people often look at it exclusively through the lens of negative stories, through YouTube videos. There's something called the availability bias. You know, if you something's easily recalled in your mind, you think it's much more common than it really is. There's 75 million police interactions in the United States every year from a police force that has 800,000 people. That results in around 1,000 shootings. Most of those shootings are people armed with guns. Then there's people armed with knives. I think something like 40 of them are people who are unarmed, right? Mm-hmm. Some of those unarmed people were trying to tackle the police and take their guns, right? Which it would be a situation where it would be considered justified to shoot. So the total number of people who are shot and killed by police unjustifiably in the United States is probably going to be in the dozens out of a 330 million population, out of a police force with 800,000 people. That doesn't mean those shootings are not tragedies. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing everything we can, both on the supply and demand side, to try to reduce those shootings. But it does mean that this isn't really a catastrophic moment where you have to dismantle this entire institution. It's a moment where I think New York and Washington, D.C. are really good examples. We should be looking at the practices of the police. And by the way, we should be looking at crime. The less crime you have, the more you'll be able to protect people. There's a reason hundreds of people were being shot in the 1970s in New York City, because it was the most dangerous time to ever be in New York City.
This is the this is just the perfect pivot point, just because I want to, because it gets back to my earlier question of, is this crime policing issue a cut on the hand, or is it a festering wound that could kill someone? The response to the point about if there's less crime, you can protect people better, you could say, yeah, like, and the response to that was locking up a generation of, like, black and brown men. So the broader question for you within that dynamic is, like, what is your racial diagnosis of the broader, of, like, this broader issue? So, like, are we in this society that is truly plagued by racism that is so bad that it sort of overwhelms the sort of, like, advantages of the system? Or is it something else? What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so they do, there are people who study this professionally, and what they do is they use statistics, they try to control for variables, and they try to find out, like, how much of this is racial bias versus, like, racially disparate outcomes based on behavior patterns, based off social conditions, so on and so forth. I think when people have studied this, they typically do find that there is at least some racial bias in, for instance, police stops. So there's something called the veil of darkness, which these studies basically find that police stop fewer black people at night. And the reason why is pretty simple. They can't see their race. You can't see in the car who's driving. That's something that does show up. And also, we tend to find a little bit of an increase in terms of your conviction rates, your length of how long you're sentenced to in prison, if you're like a black male. So there definitely is some like racial bias in our system. And I think almost nobody who's credible or serious would deny it. I don't know, maybe Ben Shapiro would deny it, I don't know. But I don't think most people wouldn't deny there's at least some. What's not acknowledged, I think, is that it's probably less of a factor than people think. And it's primarily based more on the inputs of behavior than it is on bias on behalf of like individual police officers. So for instance, like the African-American homicide rate in the United States is like 5 times as high as the white homicide rate. It tends to be a much younger population than the white population, and people tend to commit crime more when they're young. So that's part of it as well. They tend to be in more economically depressed, high poverty areas or unequal areas. The distribution of lead. So like one of the biggest things that scientists now think led to the crime decline in the 1990s was just that we did so much to remove lead from our communities, because lead makes it more difficult for you to control your inhibition, to control your kind of emotions. It led to like more criminal behavior in communities, actually. And so actually taking a lot of this lead out actually helped reduce the crime rate. So there were a lot of things that led to, I think, just a much higher violent crime rate that tended to overrepresent African Americans, that led to a lot more police interactions with African Americans, and tended to lead to higher incarceration of African Americans.
So that's fascinating, but this is sort of the problem though, and this is why these debates and the terms are so important, is that every single thing you just described, Ibram Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, sort of like the chroniclers of like the anti-racist moment, would say that those things are racism. They'd say, exactly, yes. Zed,
that's
there is
environmental racism.
Exactly, yeah, right. the redlining. So it's interesting because, yeah, I don't know. There's no take here. It's just that they would just say that all of the structural factors you're describing are actual instances of racism. Sagar, what do you have on that?
Oh God.
No. I mean, I completely agree with you. And I guess what is our response to that, Zed? I mean, I just want to make very clear here that everybody here wants to see in a more egalitarian society where nobody gets shot, in which people feel safe when they're walking from home, and we have the opportunity to prosper as any other citizen should be able to, and that there are obviously structural forces that are keeping down certain communities, disproportionately people of color. I think that the argument always is, and that I have, you know, with the progressive leftists, is about what is that structural force and how do we address that structural force, which is a great pivot point to really the, you know, the Robin DiAngelo, Ibram Kendi. So Zed, I mean, I want to be very fair to them. Explain what their critique is, what their diagnosis of the lead, of the environmental racism is, and why you think that it's a flawed way to look at achieving the society that I think we have a shared goal on.
Yeah, so I think they differ a little bit. So like DiAngelo would probably have the more standard take, because she deals with interpersonal racism. Her belief basically is that all white people are racist. Any interaction they're having with a non-white person is going to be defined by the races of the two people involved.
And Ibram, real quick, this is, and we should just say, Robin DiAngelo wrote the best-selling book, White Fragility. Yes. Ibram Kendi wrote Stamp from the Beginning and How to Be an Anti-Racist. So these are sort of, right. These really are the biggest, right. The biggest speakers. If you go to sort of your Barnes & Noble, if it's open, they're who you're going to see.
Yeah, and so Kendi's analysis is, so her analysis is more interpersonal. Kendi's analysis is more structural. I think Kendi would probably be more likely to acknowledge the facts that I just stated. Whereas DiAngelo might try to deny them or say that I'm underplaying the white racism of the officers, for instance. Kendi would probably be more likely to acknowledge the fact that, let's say, it's been studied and Black and Latino officers are no less likely to shoot Black and Latino people. Like, they're just as likely as white officers, statistically. That doesn't mean that there's never going to be an instance of someone who's racially motivated or racially biased shooting, but it's just as likely. I think Kendi would probably acknowledge that, just because I think he's a little bit more... Yeah, his analysis is a little bit more structural. Like DiAngelo says that like non-white people can't be racist. Like flat out says that. Kendi does say they can be racist, but his analysis of racism is that anything that has a racially disparate outcome is racist, right? Even if there's no intention of racism, even if there's no history of racism, even if there's no bias or prejudice, if it just happens to yield an outcome that's not proportionate to the population, it's racist. So he would still call it racist, even if he means something very different than the traditional person, the traditional definition of racism, because the traditional definition of racism implies that somebody is expressing or feels bias and prejudice, and then they're making a decision based on that. Kendi would say it doesn't actually require any person to have that bias or prejudice. As long as the outcome is in a certain way, it's racist. Like, I don't know. I feel like if I asked Kendi if the National Spelling Bee was racist, he might say it was racist. Because Indian Americans almost always win the National Spelling Bee. It's not equally distributed among people of different ethnic backgrounds in the United States, the winners. But that's actually what he says. He says that's how it works. Now, in terms of the factors that I just described that lead to police shootings being the way they are, I'm not as invested into whether we call that racism or not. I tend to lean towards the traditional definitions of racism that basically means that it's bias or prejudice. I think I'm more invested though in the bad analysis of what leads to the killings. Because if you think that these shootings are largely a result of police officers being interpersonally racist and prejudiced against African Americans, that leads to an entirely different set of policy interventions than if you believe, like me, that it's some combination of training and de-escalation, but also some combination of that and crime rates. Because under my analysis, you have to work very hard to reduce crime rates to reduce police shootings. Under the analysis of maybe Robin DiAngelo, the only thing you could do is maybe hope that white officers are less racist, you know, or not have the police there to begin with, because they don't have any choice but then to shoot because they're so racist. I think it's very, very important for people to acknowledge that these police-civilian interactions, you know, there's the $75 million a year with 800,000 officers. They're all individual interactions, right? Like, there are going to be individual officers who make the right move or make the wrong move. There's going to be criminals who make the right move and make the wrong move. It's not a matter of the police are all sitting in a room somewhere and they say, we're just going to go shoot people today, right? Like, it's not a policy. It's not a structural choice. It's more or less a matter of a pattern of interactions between lots and lots of individuals, almost all of which do not end up in anyone being shot. Well, the ones that do end up in people getting shot, that's when we look at those individual cases and we say, was the police officer justified in using force? Were there alternatives to the police officer using force in these cases? And I think when you find a pattern of those, like you say that, you know, police do not have tasers in this town, or they do not have some technology, or they did not have backup, then you can change that policy, I think, to change that. But there's no silver bullet to making sure that all 75 million interactions all go well, right? Right now, almost all of them go well, but the ones that don't, that the ones that arise to YouTube videos that are used to instigate rioting in some cases, you know, those are the ones where we're going to have to look deep into how you can change some combination of police practices in that department, because there's like 18,000 police departments and they're all different. Or you're going to have to look to see is there some way to reduce the overall violent crime rate, just to see if that there are less cases where the police are called on someone who's brandishing a knife or has just shot someone, or, you know, those are the circumstances most likely where people get shot by the police.
So help us understand this then, because, and this is sort of why I push back against people who sort of focus on studies and data to say, wait, you know, police shootings of black men have gone down since 2014. So what's the matter? Why are people mad? Why are people protesting? Because it sort of begs the question. That's not what begs the question means. So I need to be precise about that. But it makes you ask, then why are people so pissed? Right. So if it's true that the vast majority of police interactions go well for the vast majority of people, why are black people, why are brown people so pissed off in this country? Like, why is there all this animus? Why does it seem like all of these tiny towns, everywhere from Wisconsin to DC to New York to California, why is there this tinderbox? Like, what's going, is this the deeper sort of hyper, what is it? Like, what's going on in this country?
Okay, so like, I feel like the Buddha said this at some point, or someone old sage said this, but like, the world, there is objective reality is almost not a useful concept to talk in terms about how people feel about things. We construct the world in our own minds. So everyone's going to have a different interpretation of data. Everyone's going to have a different interpretation of the reality of what's happening in the country. And I think we also have to realize that it's not just police shootings. Like, if you poll people year after year, there tends to be a lower African-American trust of the police, and there tends to be a lot more police interaction with African-Americans, partly because there's a lot of police in like inner cities where there tends to be a lot of crime. And I think when you have more and more interactions with the police, at least some of those are going to be rude, they're going to be crass, they're going to be abusive. Mm-hmm. So even, you know, most people don't get shot by the police, but a lot of people may get racially profiled. You know, they may get pulled over. In a complete kind of inappropriate way. They may have, a police officer may say something inappropriate to them or be rough with them. So there are those experiences as well. There's not just the shootings. But to add to that, I would say that, you know, the world is as we interpret it, and that's the reality in our minds. And I think you have to look at like news media consumption over the past few months. You know, we have seen anytime anyone is shot in America, where it's somewhat uncertain circumstances or somewhat controversial, there's saturated coverage of it. And I imagine that if you polled people about how often they think this is happening, they probably think there are thousands of people shot and killed by police every year, almost all of them unjustified. They probably think it happens mostly to black people, although actually twice as many white people are shot as black people. And I think the actual rate per population that's highest is actually Native American. But this context is not ever really given. It's just a matter of a video is posted. It's very uncertain what happened. And then, you know, you have news anchors and celebrities coming out and comparing Jacob Blake to Emmett Till, when the two cases have no relationship to each other other than them both being black, I guess. You have people saying we're being hunted. You know, at some point, people have this emotional feeling that this is happening all the time to people everywhere. People start to feel afraid that they, especially particularly if they're African American or if they're minority, they start to feel afraid themselves that this will happen to them. And it's not 100% irrational when you have a saturated environment telling people about the nature of this one very specific problem. I think we've had many similar kind of panics in American public life, everything from child kidnappings in the 80s to general crime in the 90s to Y2K, the African killer bees, so on and so forth, where I think when one topic is very much focused on, it becomes huge in people's minds. And I think it's almost a natural kind of emotional response that people would have. And there is some legitimacy to it because there are bad shootings. There are, I mean, I think every, it wasn't a shooting, but I think basically every police department in America watched the George Floyd video and said, why did he keep his knee on the neck for that long? Why wasn't he calling doing CPR? Why wasn't he calling paramedics? So many people like can look at that and say that that's wrong. But it's very different than saying this incident was wrong, that officer needs to be investigated and perhaps even arrested and prosecuted, and saying that if you're black in America, you have a very high chance of being killed by police. You have a very, 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 very low chance of being killed by police, no matter who you are. Especially if you're not brandishing a gun or a knife and you haven't committed a violent crime, you have almost no chance of that ever happening to you. And yet we had people going on, you know, CNN and talking about how it's worth protesting even in COVID restrictions because we have two viruses in America. No, right. We only have one virus in America that killed 150,000 people already. The other thing kills very, very few people, you know? So, but the news media wasn't presenting this in an act, you know, like an accurate context, right? So I can barely blame people, honestly, if they're just reading the New York Times or listening to NPR, you would think this is a pressing like possibility for like every black person in America. all the time. And if you do think that, it probably does make a lot of sense to break COVID restrictions and to protest and maybe even to do more than that. So
my last question for you, Zed, really focuses on one of the most profound segments I think that you had on Rising with me, which kind of comes back to some of the ideology that we discussed before around the 1619 Project, which was, you know, Nicole Hannah Jones. She at the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for this and for an essay in particular, in which there was a claim that one of the, you know, chief reasons for the American Revolution was slavery. And one of the things that you and I discussed on Rising was that the 1619 Project and, you know, stamped from the beginning, Ibrahim Kendi and much of this ideology focuses and tries to blame our current public policy problems and our current disparate outcomes based upon race and our current disgraceful system in which so many working class Americans, disproportionately people of color, are unable to prosper in the United States upon something that happened 400 years ago. And you talked about how it's so much more, it's not just about useful, but the practical realities and the lived experience of so many were of these people I'm discussing is that it has much more to do with policies that actually happened, not just 400 years ago, but even after 1968. So let's end on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a sort of, and this isn't exclusive to the United States, this happens in other places in the world. There is a time when I think people focus or fixate on history the same way we treat religion, which is that we tell the stories of past sins, we tell the story of historical injustices and how our ancestors overcame them. And we focus on that in a way to where almost we substitute that history for the present, right? We say that the exact same thing that was happening then is happening now, or that what happened then defines what happens now. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu consistently bringing up what ancient Persia did to talk about, you know, his foreign policy towards Iran, or I'm thinking about maybe the BJP, the right-wing party in India. Sometimes they'll talk about things that happened 1,000 years ago. You know, the Muslims took over this area. They enslaved our people back then. So right now we have to build a temple there, or so on and so forth. There's a version of that happening in the United States now, because you can read the 1619 Project and never realize that it was, you know, Barack Obama and Eric Holder who failed to rebuild all that destroyed wealth during the Great Recession, because they didn't hold banks accountable and they didn't, you know, they didn't stop all those people from losing their homes. You can read an article about the wealth gap in 1619. Nothing like that will show up. You know, they'll be talking about redlining. They'll be talking about Jim Crow. They'll be talking about slavery. They'll be talking about things that were very long past. They do have some impact on today, as anything that happened in the past, like the creation of the combustible steam engine or the Industrial Revolution. Like, those also had huge impacts on life today. But they were not the proximate causes of so much of what is happening today. And I think part of that was the 1619 Project, Robin DiAngelo, to a less extent, Kendi. I give him some credit. I think he actually does a little bit better on this. But this larger kind of critical race theory ideology, it posits white people as basically the only agents of history, right? Like, what they do matters. What everyone else does doesn't really matter. Or if it does matter, it was only like, you know, it was only glorious, right? Like, it doesn't mm-hmm. give them the full humanity of doing some things right, doing some things wrong, making mistakes, stumbling sometimes. I don't think you can talk about the United States today and pretend that non-white people are not actors. There are some really great public officials, and there are some really crappy public officials. There's some of both, and I think their policy decisions are impacting so much of the topography of today's landscape. It's not just a matter of white folks are the only ones doing things. And I think that very flattened image presented by this ideology is preventing people from seeing so much of what could be changed today. I'll give you an example. When I was in Atlanta, one day I reported on a story where there was an apartment tower in downtown where mostly black and poor, where people were just passing out because it was so hot in the summer and their air conditioning was all broken. And the people who owned the apartment tower would not fix it. The people who owned the apartment tower happened to be like people who were part of this like wealthy black celebrity mega church. And so I went to a rally outside the apartment tower, and this one from the Nation of Islam showed up and he said, "This isn't the Caucasian doing this to us. It's people who look like us." And it was interesting what he said, in that almost like it was an expectation that if somebody looks like you, or maybe they share some cultural history with you, or so on and so forth, somehow they're on your side and they're doing the right thing. It's always going to be the other ones that aren't doing the right thing. And the NOI guy said this almost as if it was a surprise to him, or like it was worth pointing out. Like the default assumption is that, you know, everyone of one skin color kind of sticks together. But that's the reality. There are so many problems in America where you have people who are Black or Latino or Asian. You know, they're either in private firms, corporations, or they're public officials who have badly failed their communities. And their failures can only be ameliorated by holding those people accountable. If you strip them of accountability and say it's just the white people, you're never going to get good governance in Baltimore, right?
So I was we were I was gonna let this lie just in terms of finishing up the episode, but I think this is actually super interesting. So I just want to ask you, it seems to me though that you're not making the case against the 1619 project, or claiming the 1619 project is the cause of that situation with the megachurch, because it seems to me that what you're advocating for is, look, there's a 1619 project. We could discuss the history of redlining and a lack of Black wealth, a lack of Black access to programs such as the New Deal, which builds this sort of thing. Like earlier in the episode, you're talking about how there's like a crime, there's a policing issue because a lot of Black people live in the inner city. Well, like that's because like redlining and those sort of policies. So why can't we walk and chew gum in the same time here, right? So why can't, you know, the New York Times make racism porn for upper middle class people, which is what the 1619 project ultimately was. Like, why can't we do that? And then also do the 2020 project, which is like very obviously from your perspective, very progressive and very aggressive, and would like adjudicate things like, hey, like why didn't President Obama do more during the, 2008 financial crisis after space to address the home issue? But like, the last thing before I throw it back to you is that, well, that's actually even more complicated too, because like, let's get real. It's not as if like the Republican Party was particularly excited for mortgage bailouts. Like that's actually ironically how the Tea Party literally started, when whoever that guy at CNBC was saying like, we're not going to bail out people who screwed up. So, and actually now that I'm thinking about it, if anything, the response to the guy who said we shouldn't bail out people who screwed up in 2009 was, but hey, like there's this actual longer history here going back to 1619, arguably, which means that this isn't just people screwing up. This is people doing structural forces beyond themselves. So, what's your just response to my rant here? Because I think there's so much here.
Look, that was my actual problem with 1619 Project. I don't, there is a rich history of just absolute subjugation and oppression in the United States that should be told. And it's particularly the history of slavery, particularly the history of also, you know, the history of Jim Crow and segregation and redlining. Like, I don't think many people know this, but like Alabama had a law, a specific law saying that a Black person and a white person couldn't play checkers together. Like, what's that all about? Like, these are like horrific things that existed in our history, and it's worth learning about them so that we don't make those kind of mistakes in the future. But you can't learn about them in place of recognizing and acknowledging the reality that you're in today. I don't think, for instance, the BJP in India should be talking endlessly about what Muslim invaders did to India 500 years ago, which they are obsessed with doing and they're constantly talking about. Because guess what? Hindus in India today have agency, and the BJP is ruling the country of India. They need to be doing better to tackle a lot of these problems, just as Barack Obama and Eric Holder needed to be doing better in tackling a lot of these problems. And I think the 1619 Project attempted to replace the present with the past. It
That's it.
tended to blame basically everything that's happening now on white racism in the past, when some of it can certainly be blamed on that. But a lot of what's being screwed up in America today is multiracial. People of all kinds of racial backgrounds are making the wrong decisions. People in power. America today has all people of all races and all kinds of positions of power, particularly in local government, where they just did completely the wrong thing. I'd love to see someone from 1619 explained to me why Atlanta is a relatively well-run city and Baltimore is a terribly run city. Both were, you know, part of the legacy of the South. Both were run by African Americans, but one just had a different set of people who made different decisions. I don't want to know about those decisions, right? I don't just want to see this superstructure of structural racism in the body, and this is why everyone's, you know, not everyone's in the same place, right? And I think that's primarily what I had an objection to. I have no, I think there is a right-wing objection to this. It just doesn't like, you know, there's, I think Okay, so like Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife, ran a campaign in the early 90s against like liberal historians, basically attacking curriculum standards because basically she thought they made America look too bad. I'm not too worried about making our past look bad. There are some bad things in our past. What I'm worried about is reducing our entire present to that bad history of the past and making really torturous claims that history defines what's happening today in the United States just because it doesn't at all.
Such an important point. Zed, I mean, this has been such a fantastic conversation. Thank you for joining us, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Zed. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Final reminder on this one, make sure to scroll to the bottom of the podcast page, leave us a 5-star rating. If you're inclined to, ask us a question. You can email that question to realignmentpod@gmail.com, or you could simply leave the question in your 5-star review. And seriously, we really appreciated all the feedback that we got on the mugs idea. We would love for you guys to send us more feedback. So even if you don't have a question, what should we be doing? Should we be looking into doing some sort of small-scale online event when the country opens up again? Should we go on tour? What should we be doing? We'd really appreciate that sort of feedback.
Yeah, we always love feedback from you guys. As always, a huge shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We deeply appreciate it. And with that, we are going to see you guys next week.